www.ecosystemsolutions.com/quiz.
And do you have any final thoughts you want to share today?
Well, I'd say a final thought here is, you know, a lot of people think their hormones are quite mysterious and maybe too big of a project to take on. They just feel too busy and stressed, mostly because cortisol is too high or imbalanced. And the truth is that it's easier to get your hormones back into balance than to live with the misery of them being out of whack.
Well, it was great having you back on Health Watch today, Dr. Gottfried.
My pleasure, Dr. Niemann. Thanks for having me.
We're talking today to Dr. Sarah Gottfried, the author of The Hormone Reset Diet. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Niemann, your host.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Madness Radio. And first, I would like to thank Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear for the from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at ipdx.com. Thank you, KBOO members, and thank you, Portland Eye Care. Up next, we have our Madness Radio coming up, and then the Portland Blues Festival.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Eleanor Longden. Eleanor is a voice hearer. She's a postgraduate researcher at the University of Leeds, focusing on trauma and hearing voices. Eleanor is the recipient of the British Psychological Society's Undergraduate Award, and she is the coordinator of InterVoice, the International Hearing Voices Network Scientific Committee. And we're talking with Eleanor today about making sense of hearing voices. So welcome to Madness Radio, Eleanor Longden.
Thank you, Will. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Eleanor. And I have been really struck by your work because you're someone who hears voices. You also have clinical experience working with people. You're a trainer. You're known throughout Europe in doing your trainings on hearing voices. And also, you are one of the leading researchers on the voice hearing experience. And I know that your recent work, your PhD research, is about trauma and dissociation and hearing voices, and we're going to be talking about that. But maybe we should just get started by asking you about your personal experience. You yourself are a voice hearer. Do you want to tell us about how that emerged and what you went through and how it was that you went through the process of coming out of the mental health system and then starting your career as a researcher and a leading trainer in the hearing voices movement?
Initially, I sort of identified myself as a voice hearer from the age of 18, and it's only relatively recently that I've realized I actually have heard voices much, much longer than that, probably since the age of about five. And I have my first memory really of that experience was being in a maths lesson at school and being asked to do, you know, obviously a very, very simple maths problem, but as somebody who struggled a lot with maths and always have, feeling quite stressed at being unable to complete this task. And hearing internally this voice that very calmly observed, she is struggling with the problem. And at the time, being so young, I just assumed that this was the sort of experience that everybody had, that there was nothing strange or unusual about it. And that monologue, that just very calm, impartial narrative, was something that stayed with me on and off throughout childhood, throughout adolescence, but didn't almost become voices as I recognized them until I was 18, and this was when I was at university.
And so this monologue voice that's commenting on your experience as a third person, that was something that stayed with you all through your childhood.
That's right. And I always described myself as a person who'd buried their past, you know, put all these very painful memories, this sense of fear and shame and horror and terror into a box and sealed the lid over. And I think this is something that many, many people do. Mm-hmm. But in burying my past, I had essentially buried it alive. And all of this unresolved pain was just screaming to get out. And essentially and ultimately, of course, it did. And the beginnings of that was when I was a student at university. And it was during my second semester that this monologue voice truly did manifest as a voice, as I understood it. And for me, that meant that I began to hear it externally through my ears. It ceased to be a very private internal experience and became much more radically separate from myself. And I do sort of have quite distinct memories of that process happening. But I wasn't particularly frightened by it. I think a little bit unsettled and taken aback, and there was something slightly eerie about it at first, I think, just this sense of being invaded and imposed upon by this observer. But I became used to it very, very quickly, and it, again, very quickly seemed to actually provide quite a positive role. So whenever the voice observed, she is going to the library, she is leaving the room, she is reading a book, it was almost like it was reminding me that I was still carrying on as normal and that I was functioning and meeting responsibilities.
And then at some point that voice changed to become more negative, is that right?
That's right. And that change happened in a pretty banal situation in some ways, and it was in a seminar group with another student who used to challenge me in a very confrontational and hectoring, aggressive way, and he would ridicule my opinions, he would constantly put me down. And I never stood up for myself because I was somebody who felt it was very, very important to keep everyone happy. And I think many children who've had experiences of being tyrannized and terrorized sometimes become very diffident adults who are very good at trying to keep the peace, keeping everything calm and safe. But it also meant that I would come out of those scenarios feeling hugely frustrated and submissive. There was a part of me that felt consumed with rage, very, very angry aspect of myself that was just never being expressed. And after one such experience of being subjugated, that the voice said, as normal, she is leaving the room. But for the first time, the tone had changed and the voice sounded angry. And I was hugely intrigued by this and wondered immediately, what is it about this particular circumstance that makes the voice react in this way? And I realized very quickly that it was my own externalized sense of anger. This feeling, this anger is almost not strong enough. I think it was rage that was disowned by myself but expressed by the voice. And in the next seminar group, I conducted almost like a little experiment in a way, and this time I did stand up for myself. And it was quite mild, but by my standards, that was almost a revelation to be assertive. And sure enough, on leaving the room, the voice had returned to normal. And that was a very early demonstration for me of how the voice that I heard was very closely linked to my own emotional life.
So did you notice the same pattern continue, that times when you weren't standing up for yourself or being assertive, that the voice would start being angry?
Well, interestingly, it was after that particular experience that I made a decision that would have a catastrophic impact on the next few years of my life, which is that I told somebody what was happening. Mm-hmm. And this was a friend at university who asked me why I seemed so satisfied with how the seminar had gone because it was, you know, well known in my sort of group of friends that I hated this particular seminar group, and I was very frank with her, and, you know, far too frank in that I described this voice hearing experience, and she was utterly horrified. That's the equation, really, that is society's equation that says voice hearing equals insanity. She was very insistent that I make an appointment to go and see the GP on the university campus, the general practitioner, which I did subsequently, and that was my second error of judgment.
Then what happened?
I went to see him with reasonable expectations, and I sat down and began to tell him about, you know, I'm worried about the future, I have really low self-esteem, I'm anxious all the time, all this kind of things. And he was palpably bored when I was talking about these things. And then I said, oh, and there's this voice. And he swung round and literally dropped the pencil in his eagerness and was sort of saying, oh, you're hearing voices. Oh, you must tell me more about this. And I was, again, sort of so eager for help that I was immediately struck that he was interested in me and immediately began to tell him all about this voice hearing experience, essentially sort of digging my own grave. You know, I always wish the voice had actually said, she is digging her own grave, because he gave me, I guess in a way it was almost like a kind of present state examination, because he was saying things like, you know, does it hurt you, tell you to hurt yourself? Does it tell you to hurt other people? You know, all these kind of things. And I was saying, no, nothing like that. It just comments on what I'm doing in the third person. Now, what I didn't know then, but that obviously I know now, is that voices commenting or conversing in the third person is seen as one of the first rank symptoms of schizophrenia, although interestingly that will be removed most likely from DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health. So it is now recognized that voices commenting and conversing should not be seen as a sign of schizophrenia, and that's a triumph really for the work of the Hearing Voices movement and others. But it also is a tragedy for the hundreds of thousands of individuals who've received a diagnosis of schizophrenia on those grounds. And that was essentially what happened to me, because the doctor said, you know, immediately, I think you need to see a specialist, a psychiatrist, and made the referral. And that was the beginning of my descent, not only into the mental health system, but also into real madness.
So what happened then? You went to the psychiatrist and...
I went to see the psychiatrist over a period of months. Ironically, it was the fact that I was carrying on that was the catalyst for my first hospital admission in some ways. Because when I was at university, I was part of a student television station. Basically, what happened was I'd gone to see this psychiatrist, and the appointment was running very late, as was customary. And I said to him, sorry, doctor, I've got to go. I'm reading the news at 6. And it's down in my medical records, Elna has delusions that she's a television news broadcaster.
So then you were put into the hospital against your will? Is that what happened? Or
My first admission was a voluntary one, and the doctor had said to me, or the psychiatrist, I'm not really sure what's going on for you, Elna. I think it would be a really good idea if you came into hospital just so we can keep an eye on you, so we can get a better idea of how to help you. And went to the hospital on the understanding that it would be for around 3 days, which was what I was originally told. And in reality, that admission was much closer to 3 months.
Oh, wow. That's when you started to really deteriorate, is that right, being in the hospital?
No, that's absolutely right. And the place that is set up to offer distressed individuals sanctuary and safety is so often, far too often, is the place that really does nearly destroy people once and for all. And I think I sort of became aware very, very soon after entering this environment that if I was going to recover this lost sense of self, this disowned sense of self, then this hospital was not going to be the place to do it, because I was immediately defined in terms of this biomedical model of illness and disabilities, carnivorous disease called schizophrenia.
So what was it that happened in the hospital? You started to get worse and worse, it sounds like.
I think the the way that I understand voice hearing, I often use the analogy of a group of people. Say, for instance, because I ultimately heard about 12 voices.
So you went from hearing one voice to then you were hearing 12 voices because of the stress and the confinement of being in the hospital and the things that happened to you there?
What had been an experience, which was this voice, was suddenly being reconstructed as a symptom. Having been told that this commenting voice was a symptom of schizophrenia, when I heard it, I became incredibly fearful, very rejecting, very angry. I would hiss at it, shut up, go away. I would exhaust myself trying to find distraction strategies. And what ultimately happened, and again, I think this happens to far too many voice hearers, is that process simply served to make the voices stronger and more aggressive and more numerous. And what had begun as one voice became three, three became five, five became seven, and ultimately there was around 12 of them.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Eleanor Longden. She's a voice hearer and postgraduate researcher at the University of Leeds, and she's the coordinator of the InterVoice International Hearing Voices Network Scientific Committee, and we're talking about making sense out of hearing voices. And all the time, the doctors in the hospital are just seeing this as a deterioration of your illness.
You know, schizophrenia, I was told, is a degenerative neurological disease. You know, the word disease was used quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And as you say, this was portrayed to me as a sign that things were deteriorating and degenerating.
And of course, I imagine they gave you medications as part of this as well.
Yes, they did. My own personal experience of medication was extremely unhelpful. What these drugs are designed to do is inhibit emotion, and it means that you just never learn how to cope with it because it's all suppressed. And actually, strong emotion for many people can be part of the healing process because these things, again, I would say are, to paraphrase, this is something that Ron Coleman has talked about a lot, is a sane reaction to insane circumstances. And if you have been terrorized, demoralized, in your life, and whatever form that takes, and child abuse is one form, but there are many others, and you know, if those have been your experiences, then something very often needs to happen in order for you to heal from those experiences, to find a wholeness, to find a sense of peace and compassion towards yourself. And it's incredibly hard to do that when you are hugely sedated on these very stupefying drugs.
Do you remember a story or two that you'd like to tell us about some of your experiences in the hospital?
The one that I remember most vividly is that first admission. And one of the things that happened in that first admission was the emergence of what I would ultimately come to see as my dominant voice. And this was the voice that had the most personal relevance for me. But it was also the voice that for many years was the most cruel, the most demoralizing, the most terrifying. This was a profoundly frightening voice. And it also took on this grotesque visual manifestation of a man, immensely tall, swathed in black. And the only thing about him that was really clear is that instead of a hand, he had a hook, sort of like a butcher's hook. And it was a horrifying image. You know, what I would ultimately realize was that the image of a man in dark clothes with very malevolent intentions was, you know, even the hook itself was hugely relevant in terms of previous experience. I was, again, sort of looking at my medical records. It's extraordinary that nobody at that point made any kind of link. Very often, not all the time, of course, but too often, services really take the side of abusers, that they become complicit in the silence, almost. This complicity of silence and denial. And it's so toxic and again just perpetuates the distress.
Eleanor, how did you move from believing the disease and medical model of your voice hearing and start to really address the trauma you had experienced and then start to go into recovery from this whole experience and to get to where you are today?
I'd say in its most extreme state, sort of about 2 years before there was any sort of meaningful improvement.
And how did that improvement start to happen? Was there a turning point? When did you start to feel like you came back?
The real turning point for me, and I think the first sort of real lucky break, was when I went back home, and that for me was a place of safety. I had and still have an incredibly close relationship with my mum, who was somebody who consistently believed in me. My mum always knew that I would get through it and communicated that hope to me. And the second thing was being referred to a wonderful psychiatrist called Pat Bracken.
Pat's work is wonderful. We've actually had him as a guest on Madness Radio, so people want to check that out in the archives. So, yeah.
Yes. And he met me in sort of the first interview. So I said, oh, you know, it's lovely to meet you, Eleanor. Can you tell me a bit about yourself? And my response was along the lines of, oh, you know, I'm Eleanor and I'm 21 and I'm paranoid schizophrenic. And he sort of very gently challenged that immediately, you know, along the lines of, don't tell me what other people have told you about yourself. Tell me about you. Mm. And that was really wonderful that almost for the first time somebody in services was looking beyond this very degraded, despairing exterior and just saw a young woman in pain underneath. And Pat Bracken also believed without question that I could recover. I used to talk about Pat Bracken as saving me, and I realized I actually did something much more special than that, in that he enabled me to save myself.
And that was the beginning of your interest in joining the Hearing Voices movement and sort of making this the focus of your research career, it sounds like.
And one of the pieces of good fortune I had was to meet a range of extraordinary individuals who were working in this area, this group of very sort of progressive people who have this remarkable blend of expertise by experience, expertise by profession. Being able to be inspired by them, to learn from them, to have the privilege of friendship with them, which was something that sort of really energized me. And I think after that, once that sort of healing process had begun, then things just kept on improving. And really the theme of that on a personal level was making sense of these voices.
Eleanor, tell us a little bit about the training work that you do in helping therapists and service providers use different techniques to work with people who hear voices.
In terms of clinical work, a lot of that is focusing around something called the construct or voice profiling. This is something that was originated by Raman Escher and is basically based on the premise that voice characteristics are personally meaningful to the voice hearer and related in some way to their life history. And what we would do in a circumstance like that is ask people, it's basically five main themes around voice hearing, which is their voice's identity, their characteristics, what triggers the voices, what was the history of the voices, so what was happening in the person's life when the voices first appeared and how did they change after that. And finally, the person's life, the person's story. And we use all the information that is derived from that to formulate the construct. And the construct is basically around two main questions. Who do the voices represent, or what? Who or what is represented by the voices people hear? And secondly, what problems do the voices represent? And that information, in turn, is used to derive a recovery plan, not a treatment plan, a recovery plan. The right to enjoy a fulfilling, meaningful life is the fundamental right for every voice hearer, irrespective of a painful past. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than being possessed by your pain, you can be in possession of yourself. And for many people, mm-hmm. the voice can be a part of that process.
Eleanor, tell us about the research that you've done looking at the prevalence of voice hearing, because most of the people who hear voices don't actually experience them as distressing, and most people don't end up as patients in hospitals, but there still is a trauma connection with the origin of voices. Help us understand how that is.
That's research that I've been involved in synthesizing, so I didn't actually do the original work myself, but it was sort of a pattern has emerged if you look at a lot of the existing literature, that firstly that voice hearing is remarkably prevalent in non-clinical groups, and estimates vary, but Some studies have put it as high as 13%, which immediately indicates that there are far more people who hear voices who never enter psychiatry than there are distressed voice hearers, and that voice hearing is not in itself a rare and extraordinary experience.
It's actually a normal human variation, like being left-handed or being gay or just a part of who we are. That's part of the human experience.
That's really beautifully expressed, exactly right. It is a sign of human difference and diversity. And in some ways, that's a puzzle for psychiatry in terms of how does a prototypic symptom of schizophrenia be so common in those who are in good emotional health. One important difference between distressed or patient and non-distressed or non-patient voice hearers is that while the experience of trauma is very high in both groups, particularly but not exclusively childhood sexual abuse, emotional abuse or bullying, non-patients seem to be far more likely to have integrated and processed and made sense of that painful experience.
Eleanor, you mentioned earlier that the DSM-5 is going to be, as a result of the activism and research of the Hearing Voices movement, is going to be removing the sort of monologue, observing witness voice as a characteristic of schizophrenia in and of itself. Are you hopeful that society can change? Do you see a transformation taking place in the mental health system? I know that you're in the UK and it's a different scene over there, but are you feeling positive and hopeful that we can actually get a more humane approach to hearing voices?
Yes, I am. And I don't think DSM committee would admit that they've been influenced by the Hearing Voices Network, but I think they have. And because the Hearing Voices movement is so powerful and articulate and political, and I think the Hearing Voices movement has adopted the same kind of civil rights sort of outlook that many other minority experiences have. And it's this sort of agitation for social change, emancipation, action for respect, and sort of working in a way that isn't about changing the individual. It's not about changing the voice hearer. It's about changing society's perceptions of this experience, and in for the case of voice hearing, changing psychiatry's perception as well.
And Eleanor, we don't have a lot of time left in the interview, but tell us just a little bit about the research that you're doing, which is really groundbreaking research on the connections between voice hearing and trauma and dissociation.
Well, what I'm working on at the moment as part of my PhD is something that has been certainly articulated by many other individuals also, is the idea of voice hearing as a meaningful response to pain, to loss, to trauma, and as a suggested mechanism for that is dissociation, which is quite a complicated concept in some ways, but basically sort of refers to a psychological response to overwhelming stress. It's a form of mental flight. And basically speaking to the idea of voice hearing as a quite creative, ingenious survival strategy mm-hmm. to overwhelming events, not as a sign of illness. And again, I just really like to sort of, you know, honour the work of all the people who have influenced me and who have come before me in terms of arguing that it is simply no longer a sustainable position to think of distress as part of a disease syndrome, you know, rather than something that's meaningful, real, albeit painful or fearful or overwhelming. As Marius Rom says, this is voices speak to people in a metaphorical way about genuine problems in their life.
Eleanor, how can people get in touch with you if they want to find out more about your work and more about the International Hearing Voices Movement?
People can email me at eleanorlongdon@gmail.com or go to the website of Intervoice, which is the International Network for Education, Training and Research into Hearing Voices, which is www.intervoiceonline.org.
Eleanor Longdon, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Eleanor Longdon. She's a voice hearer and postgraduate researcher at the University of Leeds focusing on trauma and hearing voices. Eleanor is the recipient of the British Psychological Society's Undergraduate Award. She's the coordinator of the Intervoice International Hearing Voices Network Scientific Committee, and her work is focused on making sense of the hearing voices experience. Thanks for tuning in today on Madness Radio. That's all the time we have, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio at madnessradio.net.
This KBOO program has been made possible, in part, by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet service. Step House is proud to provide internet service for KBOO for transmitting to the Waterfront Blues Festival over its downtown Portland-based wireless network. More information about Step House internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net.
You are listening to the 2016 Waterfront Blues Festival on the stations of Oregon Community Media. KBOO Portland, KPOV Bend, KMUZ Turner, KWSO Warm Springs, KSOWLP Cottage Grove, KOCF Fern Ridge, KSKQ Ashland, KYAQ Siletz.
Now we're going live to the KBOO to the Waterfront Blues Festival.